Have you tried changing your health year on year, resolving that this year things are going to be different, but nothing seems to change? Oftentimes, when things are not changing, we are following many wellness myths and not looking at the full picture, including our nutrition, recovery, stress management, leaving out mind-body connection. I want to introduce you to Wellness Redefined, a new podcast from Rufilion Media that's here to dispel all your myths about wellness and fitness while sharing stories of how we redefine what it means to be healthy. On each episode, we'll be talking to experts from all walks of life who will share their own unique wellness journey and offer their perspective. I am your host, Tamika Rochester, founder and CEO of Harlem Cycle, a premier wellness space in New York City with a focus on indoor cycling. I've been an advocate for wellness since as early as I can remember. So if this sounds like something that could help change your life, go ahead and pause the show you're listening to and subscribe to Wellness Redefined on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the early morning hours of May 11th, 2003, 15-year-old Sakia Gunn is heading home to Newark, New Jersey with her cousin and three friends after a night out. Gunn is 15 years old and, like her friends, is black and gay. They've spent the evening at the Greenwich Village Piers in New York City and are now at a bus stop. Around 3 a.m., two black men, Richard McCullough, age 29, and his friend Alan Pierce, pull up to that bus stop. The men proposition the teenagers, who respond by saying they are lesbians. McCullough then starts to get enraged and yells obscenities. Pierce then parks the car at the street corner and the two men approach. McCullough puts one of the girls in a headlock and Gunn goes to defend her. McCullough calls Gunn the quote ringleader and orders her to come to him, which she refuses. He then pulls a switchblade and holds it to her throat. Gunn breaks away, but they continue to grapple, and as Gunn goes to throw a punch, she is stabbed in the chest and collapses. Gunn starts to go into shock, and her friends flag down a minivan driving by. That van rushes them to University Hospital, but it's too late. Gunn bleeds out in her cousin's arms and dies in the hospital parking lot. This is Invisible Hate. Welcome back to Invisible Hate, a weekly true crime podcast in which Sadia and I attempt to uncover the ugly truth behind various hate crimes, both recent and historical. Sadia is actually off for the week, so it'll just be me today reading this episode. And for our regular listeners, many of you know that the cases that we discuss involve crimes committed against minority groups. Our goal, as always, is to determine through a discussion of the nuances and complexities of these unfortunate situations, whether or not these transgressions can be considered hate crimes. As will soon become clear, today's case appears to fit many of the criteria for a hate crime, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. For now, let's just start with the details. So I first want to talk about who Sakia Gunn is and where she lives. Gunn is a sophomore at Westside High School in Newark, New Jersey, and she's a basketball star, a great student, and a natural-born leader. She is 5'3" and 130 pounds. She is one of the rare kids that seems to have an incredible sense of self, coming out at age 12 and finding popularity for being one of the few openly LGBTQ people in her community. She also identifies as what's called an AG, or aggressive, which is said to be pretty nonconformist at the time. According to GLAAD, an aggressive is a homosexual woman of color who dresses in masculine attire but does not necessarily identify as either lesbian or female-to-male transgender. So it's unique to black females. Gunn's go-to outfit is baggy jeans, an oversized white t-shirt, and a do-rag. While her classmates, as well as mother and grandmother, who's her legal guardian, support her preferences, her hometown as a whole isn't very accepting or diverse. Newark is a largely working-class Black community. It is a minority majority and is known for being crime-ridden with growing Black-on-Black violence. In 2003, when our story takes place, there are 81 murders in the city. This is 6 times higher than the average U.S. city per capita, but consistent for Newark. That said, between 1998 and 2002, there are no bias-related murders in the entire state of New Jersey. There are, though, 28 bias incidents directly targeting gay, lesbian, or bisexual people in the state in 2002, but those range from verbal harassment to physical assault, not death. But we have to remember, as we always talk about here on the show, that hate crimes are often underreported. So, the relatively intolerant and rough vibe of Newark is the reason Gunn and her friends love to go to New York City, especially to Christopher Street Pier, a popular and low-key hangout for LGBTQ youth. They feel safe there. On that late night in May 2003, they've just taken the 25-minute train ride back from New York City to Newark. Instead of catching the bus home directly at the train station or hopping in a cab, as one of her friends does, Gunn feels like walking the 3 blocks to another stop. The bus shelter is at a very busy Newark intersection by day, but quite quiet at 3 a.m. A police booth is right across the road, but it's unstaffed at that time. McCullough and Pierce, meanwhile, have been out cruising in Pierce's white station wagon. Some accounts say that they've been drinking. Pierce pulls up and McCullough leans out of the passenger window, harassing the girls. After McCullough is rejected, he calls Gunn a dyke. He initiates both the verbal and physical fight, eventually stabbing Gunn before retreating. Pierce neither participates nor stops it. Gunn's cousin, meanwhile, Bailey, has the awareness to get the license plate number while also attending to Gunn and getting her to the hospital. Meanwhile, Gunn's mom receives a phone call from the hospital saying her daughter has been stabbed. She rushes to the hospital with Gunn's grandmother, worried but not realizing how badly Gunn is hurt. In fact, she plans to tease her about getting her first, quote, battle scar, and maybe finally convince her to carry mace. Gunn's grandmother collapses with chest pains when they are told that Gunn has died, and her mother goes into denial. Just an awful, awful situation. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the investigation. Welcome back to Invisible Hate. So back to the week of the murder, the police release a photo of McCullough naming him the suspect. A manhunt ensues. McCullough turns himself into authorities a few days later and is taken into custody. Early on, police designate this a hate crime. A charge of bias intimidation in the first degree is extremely rare, though, in New Jersey. And McCullough is actually the very first to be charged with any bias crime in Newark. His friend Pierce cooperates with the prosecution and is said not to have aided the crime, so he is not charged himself. It takes about 6 months, though, for McCullough's indictment of 6 charges, including second-degree murder and a hate crime, to come through. Meanwhile, over 2,500 mourners show up for Gunn's funeral, including students who marched out of school. Gunn is laid to rest in a blue tracksuit. Afterwards, the gay community in Newark starts to take action. There are 2 very large public protests. Gunn's fellow high school students are angry for not being allowed to hold a memorial. The mayor of Newark, who is also Black, is criticized for his lack of action and paying lip service for promising to build a community center for gay youth with no follow-through. It's the start of a pro-gay rights movement in the city. I'm sure a lot of you are wondering what happened to McCullough. So he was indicted under the state's new hate crime law, or bias crime statute. this law requires the crime itself and the bias charge to be weighed individually for sentencing, increasing the mandatory 30-year murder sentence by 15 to 30 years, so almost doubling it potentially. He could face up to 110 years if found guilty on all the charges. McCullough's lawyer contests the constitutionality of this new statute, but the motion is rejected. Both sides eventually agree on a plea that will lead to a 20 to 25 year sentence with Gunn's family's consent. On March 3, 2005, the state drops the second degree murder charge and McCullough pleads guilty to aggravated manslaughter, aggravated assault, bias intimidation, and weapons charges. He is reluctant to truly admit guilt in his statement, trying to say Gunn fell onto his knife while he was defending himself. The judge, though, gets him to admit he was swiping the knife back and forth and also that he called her a dyke. The judge states that McCullough's lack of serious criminal record, he only had a juvenile conviction for possession of marijuana, is a mitigating factor in sentencing. The judge also rejects the notion that McCullough presents no threat of repeat offenses. McCullough ends up getting sentenced to 20 years. New Jersey's No Release Early Act requires inmates to serve at least 85% of their sentence before parole is considered. Meanwhile, Gunn's grandma says, and I quote, "If he does get out, he won't last long on the streets with the people looking to get him." Really, really scary stuff there. Now, let's get to some of those positive changes that were made locally as a result of Gunn's death. Several LGBTQ plus organizations form, including the Newark Pride Alliance, the Mayor's Advisory Commission on LGBTQ Concerns, the Essex County Executives LGBTQ Advisory Board, and Sakia Gunn Aggressives and Femmes. A scholarship fund is also established by the PFLAG, which is the Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and is made in her name. A huge mural of Gunn is also painted in Newark. In 2004, a Washington Post reporter spends months researching young lesbians in Newark and how they've been impacted. That series, called Young and Gay in Real America, is a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in feature writing. In 2008, a film called Dreams Deferred, the Sakia Gunn Film Project, is made. It explores her murder and the, quote, intersections of gender identity, homophobia, racism, and class in homage of this young, aggressive, and her community, end quote. The filmmaker Charles Chasby Brack is a queer black man living in Brooklyn and says he was compelled to make it because he related so much to Gunn. Here's a clip from the film.
We would like for the day to come when no longer can the fact that a person is gay or lesbian be used as a weapon to keep them from fulfilling their dreams.
Additionally, that LGBTQ center in Newark finally opens a decade after the murder, and a Newark LGBTQ Film Fest forms. The director of the Essex County Office for LGBTQ Affairs says, and I quote, "I feel like the strides we've made at the school level and local level, we're starting to see a difference. We have spaces where we can gather together in fellowship and love each other and support each other." He is also black and gay and was 13 when Gunn died. He says the city feels completely different now, and he has hopes for a, quote, gayborhood in the future, comprising of LGBTQ plus businesses, organizations, and venues. Let's take another break, and then we'll learn about a group in Newark who faced backlash after the murder. Welcome back to Invisible Hate. As I mentioned before the break, there was a group that faced some backlash after the murder, and that was the black community in Newark. That community was criticized for their lack of advocacy and outrage after the murder. They were accused of turning a blind eye specifically toward their LGBTQ plus community, and specifically for allegedly ignoring Gunn's death. I can say that most of the research our team did came from LGBTQ plus media sources. There wasn't a whole lot of mainstream or Black-centered coverage of the murder, even locally. There could be many reasons for this, obviously, but it does make it seem to appear that Gunn's death was largely ignored by the mainstream. In fact, we came across an interesting comparison that was made. Regular listeners of the show will remember the case of Matthew Shepard. He was the gay student who was killed in Wyoming in 1998. And so while Shepard's murder is covered 659 times in major newspapers in the 7-month period after his attack, Gunn's only appears 21 times in that same time frame. Regardless, Gunn's homicide is quite unusual, and it's surprising it didn't get more coverage. That's because, statistically, Black females as young as Gunn are rarely murder victims. And murder victims that are young, according to the National Coalition of Anti-Violence, are most often killed by someone their own age, not a hateful grown man with a hurt ego. So the prevailing wisdom would have been that this was so rare that it would have justified it being a bigger story. And obviously, hindsight is 20/20, but as we've discussed before, people of color who are victims like Sakia routinely are undercovered by the media as a whole, unfortunately. And so now to our discussion of the hour. I really wish Sadia was here so we could discuss this, and I'm sure she would have a strong opinion. But here are the facts as to whether or not we should label this a hate crime. So first, McCullough admitted to calling her a dyke before he stabbed her. He also pleaded guilty in court. The third thing is that the Newark police lieutenant said witnesses were adamant that Gunn was attacked because of an anti-lesbian bias. And also, statistically, it's been found that aggressives, which Gunn identified as, are the subcategory most likely to be victims in an anti-LGBTQ plus homicide. So those are some of the reasons for considering this a hate crime. Some of the reasons to not consider it a hate crime. One is that it really kind of behooved McCullough to plead guilty to lessen his sentence. He also had virtually no criminal record and no known similar incidences or biases. And, you know, I think there is a question to be had as to whether this was an alcohol-induced rage. In my opinion, I am leaning more towards that this was a hate crime, though I think this case is a tough one to make that determination. But I'm really glad that Sakia's family was on board with the sentencing and the labeling of his crimes by the court. I'm really interested to know what Sadia thinks of this, and maybe next week she'll share her opinion on this case. I'm also interested to know what you think, whether or not this should have been considered a hate crime or not. Let us know for sure. And moving on, what is the latest? We always want to know. Both Gunn's mother and more recently her cousin have become LGBTQ plus and anti-violence advocates. Meanwhile, McCullough was released from prison on May 13, 2020, and we don't really have any other information available about his whereabouts. To end on a more positive note, 20 years after Gunn's death, a celebration of life and a street naming ceremony for Gunn was held in Newark. It was also on the 14th anniversary of the passing of the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Hate Crimes Prevention Act, which we've covered a lot on this podcast. The mayor presiding at the celebration had lost his own sister, who happened to be Gunn's favorite coach and teacher, to anti-LGBTQ violence. Here is a clip from the naming ceremony.
Maybe one day we'll honor Sakia Gunn Day. Maybe today we'll walk down Sakia Gunn Way. Yes. And maybe one day we'll all be bold enough to be Sakia Gunn Gay. Stand up for yourself. Stand up for your life. Sakia Gunn. Say her name!
Sakia Gunn!
Say her name!
Sakia Gunn!
Say her name! Sakia Gunn! Sakia Gunn! Sakia Gunn!
I And that's going to do it for this episode of Invisible Hate. Thanks again for listening. If you want to learn more, please check out the links in the show notes. Please also email us your thoughts on this story or any other story that you think we should cover. You can reach us at info@invisiblehatepodcast.com. You can also tweet us or hit us up on Instagram. Just search for Invisible Hate Podcast. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. Invisible Hate is a joint production of Rafaleon Media and Immigrant Lee. We'd like to thank our team, which includes Michaela Strather, Emmanuel Monahan, Lindsay Gamble, and Paruma Chakravarti. Our music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Both Sadia and I will be back next week for another hate crime for us to analyze. Until then, I'm Asad Butt.